Fred, I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me, and I imagine you've been quite popular as we get closer and closer to this unique event. So what has your schedule been like?
Well, I've been doing a lot of traveling and to various venues and speaking about the eclipse. But now I've sort of come to an end of all that traveling. I've carved out my getting ready for the eclipse itself because I've got a lot of equipment, gear, and planning to do.
What kind of equipment do you use to look at the eclipse, to monitor what's going on?
I'm doing primarily photography. So at this particular eclipse, usually I'm limited to, when I'm traveling around the world to an eclipse, you know, I'm limited by airline restrictions, so I've only got a couple of 50-pound suitcases. But this time, since the eclipse is here in the U.S. and I'm going to drive to it, I can fill an entire SUV up with equipment. So I've got a lot more gear than I normally would take because of that possibility. So I've got two German equatorial tracking clock drives, astronomical mounts that can track the sun. On each one of those, I've got two telescopes with DSLRs and a video camera. And then surrounding me, I'll have probably another 8 or 10 various tripods with things like GoPros and wide-angle cameras and time-lapse and things like that. So it'll be a very busy time. And it takes a while to get that all orchestrated so that I can get everything running during the eclipse itself.
Yeah, it's some pretty serious gear. But you've been known to take some incredible photos. The U.S. Postal Service released a commemorative stamp with a touch-sensitive feature, and this stamp features your work. I have a two-part question. One is, how did you take that incredible photo? And then how did that stamp come to exist?
Well, the photo was taken in Libya, in North Africa, back in 2006 during an expedition that we had. We had about 80 people in our group. And we were set up in a big tent camp that the government had set up for eclipse tourists. So we're probably over 1,000 people in this tent camp. On the eclipse day, I shot that with one of the telescopes that I'll be using this year. And it's actually a composite photograph. And by that, I mean it's composed of about 20 separate exposures at different shutter speeds. The sun's corona has an enormous range in brightness, and you can take that all in with the eye, but it's very difficult to capture with any single image. This is a process well known to photographers called high dynamic range imaging, where you take multiple exposures at different shutter speeds and you try to compress the brightest and the faintest parts of the subject into one photograph. So that the image we shot in the desert there with multiple exposures, and then at home I did a lot of computer work to combine all these photographs into one final image.
It's my understanding that looking at that corona in such a way, the way it's depicted in this photo composite, is not something we've always been able to do easily, and it's not something that's easily done from space either. You have to do it from Earth, right?
Yeah, well, a couple things here. The techniques for making this high dynamic range stuff really had to wait until the age of digital photography, which is really not that new. You know, I wasn't that long ago where I was using 35-millimeter film, and I only had 36 exposures in a given camera to shoot during totality. Now we've got digital cameras with 30 and 40 megapixel sensors, and we can shoot thousands of photographs during the eclipse. So it's become a lot more easy from the technological point of view. In terms of imaging the corona from the ground versus space, we can look at the sun's corona from spacecraft like SOHO. They have a telescope specially designed for photographing the sun's corona because it creates an artificial eclipse by blocking the sun's disk. It's got an occulting disk built right into the telescope that blocks the sun. But that occulting disk is quite large. In order for this to work effectively, it's quite large, and it really blocks not only the sun but a lot of the inner corona. So we can't see that from space. What we can do is we could see that very effectively from the surface of the Earth during a solar eclipse. So we get much better views of the inner corona from the ground than we can from a spacecraft.
Where will you be along the path of totality?
Well, I'm planning on being up in Casper, Wyoming. There's a big astronomy conference called AstroCon that I'll be giving a couple of talks to. But then I have to basically see what the weather is going to be for Casper on eclipse day. Maybe about 1 to 2 days before the eclipse, I have to evaluate whether it looks like we've got a good forecast. And if we don't, then the day before the eclipse, I'll be traveling east or west up to maybe 700 or 800 miles to get to a better location if I need to.
here in West Kentucky, emergency management officials have been preparing for tens of thousands of visitors coming here during for the point of greatest eclipse. And then just north of us in southern Illinois is the point of greatest duration. Why is the totality longer in some places?
Part of that has to do with the fact that the angle that the moon's shadow hits when it's moving across the Earth, when it's at a steep angle, its linear distance means it moves across the Earth's surface a lot faster. The other thing is when you get into the middle of the path, that is not near the sunrise and sunset points of the eclipse path, but closer to where high noon is taking place, then the rotation of the Earth is, to a small degree, counteracting the motion of the moon's orbital motion in it, and it makes the eclipse longer at that point, too. On top of that, the eclipse is longest in the center of the path and drops off to zero when you get out to the edges of the path. So there are a number of factors in there changing the duration or affecting the duration of the total eclipse.
Just to go back for a moment to the basic fundamentals, can you describe what a total solar eclipse is and how it's different from a lunar eclipse?
A total solar eclipse, or any solar eclipse for that matter, only happens during the new moon phase, when the moon is passing between the Earth and the sun. Now, most of the time, the moon has two shadows. It has an outer, faint outer shadow, which is called the penumbral shadow. And that's the shadow where a partial eclipse takes place. The inner shadow is the umbral shadow, and that's where the total eclipse takes place. And during the total eclipse, the moon completely blocks the sun's disk so that we can see the much fainter solar corona. But that umbral shadow in the center, by the time it reaches the Earth, it's quite small. It's only typically 50 or 100 miles wide. So you have to be in that very narrow shadow. The path is quite long because it stretches across the Earth from the sunrise point to the sunset point. So it might be 10 or 12 or 14,000 miles long, but only 50 or 100 miles wide. And you've got to be in that narrow shadow to see the total eclipse. Now, lunar eclipses only take place during full moon. So they're only visible at night. Solar eclipses are visible in the daytime. And when a lunar eclipse takes place, it's not the moon's shadow that we're seeing. We're seeing the moon pass into the Earth's shadow. And at that time, the entire nighttime hemisphere of Earth experiencing night can look up and see the moon. So it's visible from a much larger area than a solar eclipse is. So most people have seen a lunar eclipse, even a total lunar eclipse. But to see a total solar eclipse, that's tougher to do because it's restricted to such a small fraction of the Earth's surface. This eclipse that we're having this summer, even though that eclipse path is over 10,000 miles long and about 70 miles wide, it only encompasses about 0.25% of the Earth's surface. And only in that path can you see the total eclipse. So it's a very small fraction of Earth that gets to see that total phase of the eclipse.
And if you're not in the path of totality, you will still see some form of the eclipse, right?
Yes, because the penumbra, the much larger penumbra shadow, where the partial eclipse is visible, that's on the order of a continent in size. So the partial eclipse will be visible from all of North America, a little bit of South America, even a tiny bit of Africa, Europe, and Asia will see a little bit of the partial eclipse. Of course, the closer you are to that center of that shadow where the path of totality is, the larger the fraction of the sun's disk you'll see covered. So most of the U.S. will see up to a 60, 70, 80, or 90% partial eclipse.
How do we know what the path of totality is going to be?
To calculate the path of a solar eclipse, you need to know three things very accurately. You need to know where the sun is, where the moon is, and where the Earth is, with respect to each other in three dimensions in space. And once you have that basic information, then you can figure out where the moon's shadow is, because the moon's shadow points away from the sun. That's what's lighting up the moon. And with spherical trigonometry and some computer programs, you can easily calculate all these kinds of details of exactly where the moon's shadow is going to pass and how long the total phase is going to last. It's not trivial, but it's not a big mystery, at least not to astronomers.
How did people, through like most of human history and ancient peoples, know how to make these calculations? Were they able to make these calculations, and did people know that this was going to happen?
Well, we've only been able to calculate the positions of the Earth, Moon, and Sun very accurately since the time of Newton. when he produced his great work, The Principia, which is basically the laws of universal gravitation. That made it possible to create models to calculate the positions of the moon and the sun quite accurately, and the accuracy of those predictions have gotten better and better as time has gone by. We've used spacecraft to fine-tune exactly where some of these objects are in space, so we've gotten better and better at calculating those things. Before the time of Newton, in fact, if we go back to 2,000 years ago or more, then people were calculating eclipses in a very different way. They were using a very convenient fact that eclipses tend to repeat themselves every 18 years, 11 days, and 8 hours. And that's a cycle called the Saros cycle. And it involves several different motions of the moon that almost overlap when you go 18 years into the future. You get the same, even though they have slightly different periods, the periods all overlap when you go 18 years, 11 days, 8 hours into the future. So, for instance, this August 21st eclipse through the United States, if we go back 18 years, 11 days, 8 hours, there was another total solar eclipse that looked very similar to this one, but it passed through Europe and Turkey and India on August 11th, 1999. So you can use this Saros cycle to predict future and past eclipses. The Saros doesn't work if you go for periods longer than 1,500 years, because the Saros only lasts 12 to 1,500 years. But it's convenient for predicting the approximate dates of eclipses hundreds of years in the future and past. And that's what the ancients did, because they simply looked, they kept detailed records of when eclipses took place, and they recognized this period in their recordings and historical notes.
Has the eclipse ever been used for political means? Or I'm sure trying to understand what's happening has had some just fascinating political and sort of religious interpretation.
Well, there was one very interesting eclipse in the year, I believe it was 584 BC. There was a total eclipse that passed through what is now Iran, but back in those days it was Persia. And there was a war between two nations in the area, the Medes and the Lydians. And this war had been going on and off for the better part of 7 or 8 years. There would be skirmishes, and then they would recoup and get reinforcements and then start another war. Well, in the middle of the battle one day in 584 BC, there was a total eclipse of the sun. And both warring factions saw this as a sign from the gods that they were dissatisfied, unhappy with this war. So they actually laid down their weapons and had a royal marriage between the prince on one side and the princess on another, and made peace because of a total solar eclipse. So that's one of the most remarkable eclipse stories. There's another story about Christopher Columbus. This story involves a lunar eclipse, not a solar eclipse. But this was on Columbus's fourth voyage to the New World, and he had some problems with one of his ships, and he had to scuttle it on a beach in, I believe it was Jamaica, and he was relying on the goodwill of the indigenous people there in Jamaica to supply him and his crew with water and food while Columbus waited for a rescue. Of course, nobody even knew he needed help, so he had to just wait for the next expedition to the New World that would come across them and ask for help then. So it was going to be a wait of 6 months or a year or more. So the locals got a little tired of Columbus and his crew and started withholding food. And Columbus decided, he looked through his astronomical almanac that he had on board the ship, and he realized there was going to be a lunar eclipse on this one evening, February 29th, I think 1503. I may not have the year exactly right. But he knew there was going to be a total lunar eclipse. The moon was going to rise in total lunar eclipse. And he told the chief of the tribe that the gods were unhappy with his people about withholding food from Columbus, and that he was going to take the moon away from them if they didn't recapitulate. The locals didn't believe Columbus, but the moon rose, and it was blood red because it was in total lunar eclipse. And they decided they better make nice with Columbus and start feeding him again. So he sort of used the eclipse to pull a fast one over them, and they provided him with food for another a number of months before He was rescued. I think that's where Mark Twain got the idea for his story, A Yankee in King Arthur's Court, where I think the Yankee is going to be executed, and he conjures up, he tells them that there's going to be an eclipse of the sun because he shouldn't be executed. Of course, that one's all fictional.
We hear a lot about the glasses, the eclipse glasses, and you know, and of course, it's encouraged that people wear those. Why do we need to wear the glasses?
Well, it's dangerous to look at the sun on any bright, sunny day because the sun is incredibly bright. And it's even worse if you try to look at the sun through any kind of optical aid, like binoculars or a telescope. Well, everybody's got enough common sense that they know you don't stare at the sun on any bright, sunny day. But during an eclipse, you've got human curiosity factoring in here, and people are tempted to take a look. So the eclipse isn't technically any more dangerous to look at than the sun is on any regular day, but now you've got the human curiosity factor, and people are tempted to take a look. So you need these solar filters to block out over 99.99% of the sun's light, so that just a tiny fraction is allowed through so you can watch the partial phases of the eclipse. Now, you only need those eclipse glasses during the partial phases. If you're one of the lucky folks in western Kentucky and in the path of totality, then when the eclipse goes total for those 2.5 minutes, 2 minutes and 40 seconds, then you can take the glasses off and look directly at the sun, because you're no longer looking at the sun itself. The sun is hidden behind the moon, and what you're looking at is the glorious corona, the sun's outer atmosphere, that's silhouetting the moon in the sky. Mm. And that's perfectly safe to look at without the glasses. And it's quite obvious when it's safe to look and when it isn't, because when it's not safe to look, the sun is blindingly bright. During totality, you're suddenly plunged into this eerie twilight, and the brightness of the sun vanishes. You just see this ring surrounding the moon.
If you don't have the glasses, what's another way or an impromptu way of looking at what's happening?
Yeah, if you don't have eclipse glasses, there are a number of ways you can look at it. If you take a piece of cardboard and punch a small hole through it with a safety pin, for instance, or a hat pin, and then hold that out in front of you and look at its shadow on the ground, preferably on its shadow onto like a white piece of paper, you'll see an image of that pinhole on the ground, and it'll take on the crescent shape of the eclipse during the partial phases, because that little pinhole acts like a pinhole camera. Even more impressive is if you have any shade trees around. If you go underneath a shade tree during the partial phases, especially when more than 50% of the sun is covered in the deeper partial phases, when you look at the patches of sunlight get that filter down through the leaves, you'll see hundreds and hundreds of little crescents on the ground beneath the tree, because all the apertures in the leaves act like pinhole cameras. If you have a straw hat, the sunlight shining through the little apertures in between the fronds in the palm hat will form pinholes, and you'll get little crescents all over your face. You can go to the kitchen and get a pasta colander from the kitchen that has a bunch of holes in it. Hold that up and look at its shadow on the ground, and each one of the holes will project a crescent of the eclipse on the ground. So there's lots of ways to safely watch the eclipse without the eclipse glasses.
I'm going to have to get a colander. I like that. Or a straw hat.
Yeah, that's fun to do. The kids love that.
If someone wants to take photos of it, what should they do? I mean, they can't just take their iPhones out, can they?
Well, during totality, you can actually take a picture with the iPhone. During the partial phases, the sun is just so bright that it'll just show up as a huge white blob on the iPhone photo. You won't be able to see the crescent phase of the sun. And if you try to put a filter on the iPhone, the sun's image is just so tiny, you really need to get a better photograph. You really need to use some sort of a telephoto lens that you might have on a DSLR or one of these zoom cameras that have a long zoom lens to get a larger image of the sun. And for that, you do need to use some sort of filter during the partial phases, and then you take that filter off so you can photograph totality without the filter.
Many children seeing this eclipse may develop an interest in science and in space. I know a lot of scientists can trace their love of science back to a singular moment in their childhood. So my first question is, what was your moment? And then also, what do you recommend as a way to encourage and develop that interest?
That's a great point, and that's the great hope of this eclipse, that it's such an outstanding opportunity to get the general public engaged with science, and especially kids interested in science. get them to take their noses out of their Game Boys and their mobile devices for a few minutes and look up and see this example of the spectacular universe that we live in. And, you know, I encourage families to make a family trip and make sure they get into the path of totality to see the total eclipse. There are a lot of books out there that can get you started and websites that give you tips and pointers on viewing the eclipse. I've written a number of books on the eclipse. My wife has written a children's book about the eclipse. So there's a lot of material out there. For me personally, I got interested in astronomy probably when I was about 9 or 10. One of the neighbors had a telescope, and I got a look at the moon. And I said, wow, that's fantastic, and I got interested in astronomy. And a few years later, I saw a partial eclipse of the sun, and I think that was back in 1963. And that got me thinking about the partial eclipse. And I did some reading, and I found out that a total eclipse is much more dramatic, really spectacular, a once-in-a-lifetime kind of an event. So I looked up in the books and found out that there was going to be a total eclipse of the sun in the United States in 1970. So I put that on my calendar. I was aware of that when I was 11 years old, and I waited for it. And by 1970, I was 18, and I had just gotten my driver's license. And I talked my parents into letting me take the family car and drive 600 miles unchaperoned to get down into the path of totality, which was in North Carolina that year. So I drove down to the path. I had a small telescope with me, and I even managed to get some photographs of the eclipse. But after the eclipse was over, it was so incredible, so beautiful, that I knew that this could not be a once-in-a-lifetime event. I needed to see another total eclipse. So 2 years later, there was a total eclipse happening in eastern Canada in the Gaspé Peninsula. That was 1,200 miles, but I drove to that one. And unfortunately, the weather didn't cooperate, and I was clouded out. The sun was hidden in the clouds during totality. But I saw the darkness, so I knew the total eclipse had taken place. The next total eclipse was in North Africa in the Sahara Desert. So I managed to get over there for that eclipse. That was my third eclipse. And at that point I realized, hey, there's no reason to wait for an eclipse to come to me. I can go to the eclipse, and I can go any place in the world to see it. And that started a lifetime passion of traveling all over the world to see eclipses of the sun. So by now I've been to 27 total eclipses, and I've been to every single continent to see a total eclipse of the sun. So it certainly did inspire me.
I think a lot of what we know about the eclipse today is due in large part to your legacy of contributing to our understanding and your work with NASA. How did you get started with NASA?
Well, the first 20 years that I worked for NASA, it didn't have much to do with eclipses. That's something that I sort of worked into my job description over the years because I was interested in it. My initial work with NASA involved work studying the atmospheres of the planets with an instrument called an infrared spectrometer. We were looking at infrared light from the planets and their atmospheres and figuring out what the atmospheres were made of, what the physics was going on, what the temperature was in different layers, whether the atmospheres had any winds and which direction they were blowing. So I was working with a group heavily involved in this, and we did a lot of theoretical modeling. We went out to some of the big observatories in Arizona and in Hawaii to make measurements. But in the background, I was always interested in eclipses, and I was learning how to predict eclipses, reading books and doing computer programming to do this. And around early 1990s, I had published a number of articles on eclipse prediction, on upcoming eclipses. And up to the 1990s, the U.S. Naval Observatory had always published a special circular for focusing on each upcoming total eclipse. And they were having some budget cutbacks, and they were going to have to stop that service that they'd been doing for nearly 50 years. And they contacted me because they knew I had been active in the same field and wanted to know if I would be interested in producing a similar series of publications for primarily the scientific community. But there was a huge readership among amateur astronomers as well, because these books were the Bibles for each up-and-coming solar eclipse. So fortunately, I worked with a good supervisor who said as long as it didn't impact my other work, I was free to start working on publishing these specialized books for each upcoming solar eclipse, and that's how the NASA Eclipse Bulletin started. And I did those for about almost 20 years before I retired. And during that same period of time, I started the NASA Eclipse website. I actually started it on a computer in my office in the Wild West days of the Internet, when there was no restrictions Nobody really knew what the internet was, and I had learned how to program web pages, and I just started posting Eclipse maps and Eclipse tables, and it grew larger and larger and larger until by the time I retired, it was covering maps and information for 5,000 years of eclipses into the past and future.
I have it pulled up here now. There's another total solar eclipse visible in the United States on April 8th, 2024, and the path of totality just so happens to brush right along this region in far west Kentucky and southern Illinois. What should we know about that eclipse?
Well, first of all, you lucky, lucky people, you get two total solar eclipses within 7 years, where the rest of us have to travel. So that particular eclipse, that one begins in the South Pacific, across into Mexico, and then runs diagonally across the U.S. from Texas up through western Kentucky and Indiana, up to Ohio, and up through New England, right along the border between the U.S. and Canada. So Canada gets part of that eclipse as well. That particular eclipse, the moon is a little bit closer to the Earth during that eclipse, so the moon appears a little larger in the sky, and the path of totality is wider. And that means that you get a longer total eclipse. Instead of 2 minutes and 40 seconds, it's closer to like 4.5 minutes for that particular eclipse if you're in the very center of it. The bad part of that eclipse in 2024 is that it occurs in April. We all know about April showers. That's a very unstable time weather-wise for the United States. And the prospect of having clear skies is not as good as this summer. That's not to say it won't be clearer at many places along the U.S., but it's just not as likely as this eclipse this August. So I wouldn't put off seeing the August eclipse because you can wait and see the one in 2024 because the weather prospects aren't as good. Plus, once you've seen the 2017 eclipse, you will want to see the 2024 as well.
That's all of my questions. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
I like to tell people that on a scale of 1 to 10, in terms of the visual splendor and beauty of natural phenomena like thunderstorms and volcanic explosions and solar eclipses, a partial eclipse is a 3 and a total solar eclipse is a million. There's absolutely nothing that compares to seeing a total eclipse. Even a 99% partial pales in comparison to seeing a total eclipse. And if you happen to live near the path of the total eclipse but are just a little outside of it, and you just decide not to bother on eclipse day because you're afraid there's too much traffic or you just don't want to bother, your neighbors and friends that go to the eclipse and watch totality will be telling you about it and you will regret it. So make an effort to get to see that total eclipse if at all possible, because it's a wonderful, beautiful event. And we're very lucky to have it through the United States this summer.
Dr. Fred Espenak, I really appreciate your time. You've been very generous with your time, and this is very just fascinating conversation. Thank you so much.
I hope everybody clear skies on August 21st.